Welcome again, everyone. I am so excited we have an incredible program for you today. Of course, I'm Marcy Newman, your Heart Shift coach, and my guest today is Roger Ruge. Roger is, he's a real gift, I have to tell you, here from Boulder, Colorado. And Roger has such an incredible variety of offerings to the world that I had to have him come on this program. First and foremost, and Roger, I want you to really give us a little more detailed synopsis of the journey that brought you to where you are today. But just to give you a little bit of a background, Roger is actually a 20-year veteran of the police force in Santa Rosa, California. And in that 20 years of his police work, he has done everything that you could possibly imagine in terms of being in that space. And what's so amazing to me is how Roger has made this incredible journey to where he is today and what he's doing here. So, Roger, please, if you could just give us a little bit of information about your background, and then we're going to dive in and talk about the work that you're doing today, which is so spectacular.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you know, I did 20 years in law enforcement, and I did that in Santa Rosa, California, which is in Northern California. And a very interesting community. I was super blessed because throughout my career, I got to do so many things. And I'm a person who's rather easily bored with the same thing every day. I'm not the kind of person who can sit at a desk and just do the same things. I have to have variety. Police work is the ultimate in variety because you never know what you're going to face at any given time.
Right.
So I did everything from general patrol, which is just day-to-day stuff. I also worked on special street crimes units. Yeah. And the street crimes units work in the most troubled neighborhoods. And the idea is to support the people in those neighborhoods with a more assertive policing presence for the problems that are there. And in most cases, that ran the gamut from gang activity to street-level prostitution and also narcotics sales at the street level.
Wow.
So I focused on that for a number of years. It was called the Neighborhood Enforcement Team. And it was beautiful. We had one experience where I was assigned a special neighborhood called West 9th Street. And we were having drive-by shootings, stabbings every single day. And, you know, most of the people in Santa Rosa would find that really hard to believe.
Sure.
You know, but within every community, no matter how nice it is, there's these little pockets that are struggling. So we went down there, and in a three-month period, we completely cleaned out the gang prostitution and drug problem in 3 months.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. And it was a very targeted enforcement. But one of the joyful things about that was that I was so shocked that when all those elements were removed, hundreds of children were suddenly visible in the neighborhood playing.
Oh, wow.
And it dawned on me that I never saw children. And the reason was their parents would never let them outside. They were letting them sleep in the bathtubs at night because that would keep the bullets from hitting them while they were sleeping. I mean, you know, and so those kind of rewards came. And I did a number of other assignments. I worked as a traffic accident investigator and actually got paid to ride a motorcycle at work every day. I mean, come on. I did detective work. I worked in multiple investigations and homicide investigations and all kinds of things like that. And I was also the department's training manager. So I did all the training for every perishable skill you can think of. Mm-hmm. Perishable skill would be like the operation of a firearm or learning how to fight and retaining those skills. If you don't maintain them, they go away. You know. So I taught all of that, and I was very fortunate to also attend something called the Master Instructor Development Program. And that's specific to law enforcement, where over the course of a year, I learned how to build and design training programs as well as implement them.
Interesting.
Yeah. So when I left law enforcement in 2005, I also taught mindfulness practices to emergency services workers and also special forces operators in the military. about how to be mindful and present during critical incidents. And I taught that all over the country.
So what you might be picking up already is that Roger is not what you would consider to maybe be a typical police officer. Certainly not after 20 years of being on the force. And that's what makes him so unique, but also it's what makes what he offers so precious, because those experiences were stepping stones, obviously, that brought you to where you are today.
Yeah.
And I'd like to talk about that, but before we do, would you mind sharing with our audience some of the trauma that you experienced that brought you to that place where you began to recognize that you could no longer do the work that you were doing the way you were doing it?
Yeah, that's a really good reflection. And so as a police officer, you know, you go to events continuously that are for an individual to experience just one of those events in a lifetime. It would be something that they would remember forever. And you might go to multiple of those in a single shift.
By an event, you're not talking about a social event.
Yeah, I am not.
Which other people may be saying, what's he talking about? I go to parties all the time. They're not traumatic.
Yeah, these are life events. Everything from having your house broken into and things taken to, you know, acts of violence that have taken place. And, you know, like I say, you know, we might experience that multiple times in a single shift. I remember one night in particular was an incredible night. I literally got in 7 different physical fights on 7 different calls for service in a single shift.
Oh, my Lord.
And that was my Monday. I had 1 week where I was...
What's the rest of the week going to look like, guys?
Precisely.
Yeah.
So I had 1 week where I was involved in 4 vehicle pursuits, one every night.
Right.
And these were dramatic crashes at the ends and, you know, sometimes shootings and things that would happen. So these events, you know, are happening to you in this saturated place. But for the most part, most of them just kind of become, okay, this is what I do. And my psychology is, if there's shots fired, I go toward it. I have no fear. In fact, I'm enhanced by the adrenaline, by the fun. I think it's fun. Where 98% of the population would be, dear God, shots are fired. They're diving for the aisles. I'm going right at it. And
but that's your programming.
That's my programming.
Yeah,
and
the
I've
conditioning
always been
that you've
like
received.
That.
Okay.
Yeah, by the way, ever since I was a small child, that's just been true for me.
How interesting is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for my point being that what would probably, I could tell you a few stories and be like, oh my gosh, they don't have that, oh my gosh, for me. They're just like, yeah, that was really fun. And you'd be like, how could that have been fun? But then there are some events that they capture you in very dramatic ways that you don't necessarily anticipate. And one of those was a triple fatal accident that I went to. I remember getting a call. I was actually 5 minutes from my shift ending. And a really bad accident had happened, and I got there, and I was one of the first people to get at the scene. And so what I'm looking at is this debris field that went for 900 feet. And there are cars wrecked everywhere.
Like an explosion.
I actually thought, my first reaction was there were so many cars damaged and so many people injured. My first reaction was a small plane must have tried to land on the roadway, because it went on for so long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just I'd never seen anything like that, so I couldn't prepare my mind for what that would be.
Sure.
What it turned out was just a very violent high-speed crash that involved a number of people. So when I look at that, you know, a police officer wants to be in control, right? Your order amongst chaos. But I'm looking at chaos that I got no order for.
Sure.
So I'm overwhelmed by that. I thought, okay, I just have to pick a place to start. And so I looked at the worst car, and I noticed some people were starting to frantically try to get around that car. So I just went there instinctually. And when I looked inside the car, I'm going to spare you some of the details.
Sure.
Because it's just too graphic for people to hear, even just to hear it. But when I looked inside, I saw 2 children who were deceased. And my mind put my daughters in those places. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean this literally, I saw my children in the back seat of that car. They weren't there, but my mind put them there.
Sure.
So then I stood back and I shook that off and I looked again and realized, okay, those aren't my kids. Notched down a little bit, but it's still two dead children, you know? And so we had to deal with that scene. Now, you know, I was there 5 minutes before the end of the shift. It took us 20 hours to process that scene. So I was on duty for over a day without any breaks, without anything. You just work. Well, that event really imprinted inside me. So when we talk about traumatic events, we go through a lot of stuff, but some of them really stick. And that was one that really stuck.
Did you realize the level of the impact on you at the time?
Not a clue. I remember being shocked. Mm-hmm. I remember being a little disoriented for a couple of days after from sheer exhaustion.
Sure, of course.
But then just went back to working.
Wow.
But then things started to change.
Like what?
Little things. I started to risk my life in a multitude of ways. So, for example, I really liked martial arts. So I did full contact martial arts, sparring, where there's no gloves. It's, you know, this is before mixed martial arts and all that, but we just fight, and I liked it. I would go mountain biking, and I would just, you know, do things that were well above my pay grade of skill, you know, and I'd just go for it.
Yeah.
I did motorcycle road racing. So, you know, there's nothing that is more intense than throwing yourself into a corner at 100 miles an hour with your knee on the ground, right?
So you were constantly putting yourself at greater and greater risk.
Right, and it was because...
Tempting fate a bit.
Definitely tempting fate. And the story I told myself at the time was, this is just a lot of fun, right? But the truth was, there were two things happening there. The first thing that was happening was, in those moments of extreme risk, this stops talking and you're fully present. And the only way I could become present was to risk my life. Whew. Because there's too much static, too much going on.
So you're physically removing the safety around you in order to get at what you were searching for, that connection within you.
100%.
Wow.
And then that began to transfer to work. Mm-hmm. And so at work, I would throw myself into situations where I really shouldn't be doing that. I should be waiting for backup or doing what proper procedure would tell you to do, but I just went in anyway. And the remarkable thing was I kept working out. And I kept getting awards from the department for bravery and all these things. But then I came to realize, after a very pivotal moment where I was in a deposition, I came to realize that those things I was doing, I was actually trying to kill myself. That I just didn't want to be here anymore and I wanted to go out with my boots on.
Wow. Self-destructive.
No doubt.
To the core.
Yeah. But it was a very slow shift to that. It wasn't instantaneous, but once that train left the station, it got a lot of momentum. And then I was seeking it wherever I could find it.
Actually, we might even say it was a slow death of itself.
I would agree.
Yeah. More and more disconnect.
More and
from
more.
From the core of your being.
You bet.
Yeah.
Because to face the shadows is ultimately terrifying.
Sure. So you just kept going and going and going. And
yep.
How wonderful that your department kept rewarding you for that. So they were clueless. They had no idea to start asking questions. What's happened to this guy?
Yeah.
Why is he suddenly going rogue, right?
Right?
And why is he putting himself at risk? So they saw it as this incredible accomplishment, and yet what was underneath it was a suicide mission.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Interesting.
Very.
Interesting. So what happened? Tell us more.
Yeah, I had a moment where that accident we talked about, the one with the deceased children, it took 5 years for that to work its way to court because there were so many injured parties, multiple people. So I was showing up for a deposition. Now, a deposition's a little less than court. The rules are a little more relaxed. And you usually meet in an office with a table. And so that's where I went. And I walk in, and there are 8 18 attorneys in the room.
Oh, it's just intimidating.
Just slightly. That's a shark tank, right?
Yeah.
Because every single one of them has some interest in what I'm about to say. It's either going to help them or hurt them. So, you know, it's a very adversarial and hostile environment.
Sure.
So I'm on guard for that.
Sure.
But, I, you know, I've been a police officer a long time at this point. I'm very professional. I understand all the dynamics. And one of the things I had done at the original accident scene was I took photographs very contemporaneous to the event. That turned out to be super important because emergency services, as you can imagine, we had everything there. Everything the city had was there.
Wow.
And that destroys the evidence because life-saving trumps evidence collection.
Mm-hmm.
But I took the photos before a lot of that happened because there just wasn't much I could do.
So you were a first responder.
First responder.
Mm-hmm.
And those photos turned out to be very pivotal. So as I walk in and I sit down, there's I must have taken about 150, 200 photographs, and they're all there, every one of them. And they're like, we want you to go through every single photograph and tell us what you see. I'm like, yeah, okay. The first photograph is that car with the kids.
Oh.
Now, the interesting thing that happened to me was I left the room, and I mean this in my mind.
So you didn't actually leave
the room. I didn't actually leave the room,
but
I left up here.
You left the room.
Yeah, and I had what's called a flashback. So I literally was at the accident scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I disassociated from reality. And then this was a very bizarre experience because you have to keep in mind that this isn't just, oh, I'm remembering this. No, I'm actually there.
Yeah.
And I can't tell reality anymore. That's my reality. I'm back and I'm like so confused because, wait a minute, what? Oh, my God. And I'm smelling the smells. I'm seeing the things I saw. And then when I came back into real time, I'm back in the room, but I'm crying.
Oh.
And all the attorneys are like, what the hell just happened to this guy, right? Everybody's in shock. And I just said, I'm out of here. And I just showed the photos forward and I left.
Wow.
And, of course, you can't do that, but, you know, good luck trying to stop me.
Well.
You know, at that point.
You couldn't help yourself at that point.
I didn't care.
Yeah.
I didn't care. So I went outside and I remember standing in the sunshine and feeling the warmth of that sun was so joyful. But then it all came home to me. Oh, my goodness. I have been trying to kill myself on duty. All it just cascaded. And I realized I am in serious trouble.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that's an incredible awareness that you had in that moment when all those pieces start to come together and you start to see that puzzle in entirety. And how terrifying that must have been for you to recognize that you had been living on the edge for such a long time. It's almost as if something else was controlling you.
Right.
Yeah, something else was in control of everything that you were doing, thinking, the choices you were making, the actions that you were taking.
It's interesting you say that because I visualized the puppet master.
Uh-huh.
Making the puppet me dance. That was the visual I had.
Yeah. I can only imagine how terrifying that was. And yet how empowering when we come to that place of realization and we start to ask questions like, well, do I have to stay here?
Right.
What can I do about this?
Right.
Should I do something about it? Or should I just wait and see what happens?
Right.
And I think that those are questions that do arise.
Yeah.
But very different in the results, right?
Very different.
Very different.
Yeah.
I mean, and just for general information, what Roger was describing are really sort of classic PTSD symptoms, the trigger effect of that one photo that not just triggered a memory, but took you right back into the experience where, like you said, you could smell it. You were there. That's called a flashback. And that is very prevalent with people who have post-traumatic stress disorders, right?
Yeah, they've actually changed the acronym now, which I find interesting. They're actually calling it now PTSI.
Oh.
So disorder has been replaced with injury.
injury. And I like that so much better.
Yes, injury, right?
Absolutely. It also indicates, rather than overcoming, that it can be healed.
Yes, exactly. Where before I have to live with a disorder.
Yes.
Manage a disorder.
Yes.
There's no hope of achieving freedom from that, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So, well, that's a wonderful awareness that we're seeing.
It's
a huge step. But continue on. So
you
were reliving this traumatic event.
Yeah.
Then came to this incredible realization that, oh my God, I've been on this suicide mission for 5 years. 5 years this has been percolating within me. And here I am at a very pivotal point, obviously.
Yeah, and I realized that completely. So I knew that I needed to seek help, and there were a number of modalities available at that time. And one of them was you could meet with a police psychologist, and you got 6 visits anonymously. Now, that was one of the best changes they ever made. In fact, they had just made that change only a couple of years prior, because otherwise you had to let somebody know, and then they, you know. This gave you the ability to seek some guidance without the stigma. And believe me, in that culture, if anybody senses even the slightest weakness,
of course,
you're not trustworthy anymore.
Of course.
Yeah, this is a big deal.
You have to maintain that separation between your true heart and who you need to be on the outside.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I went to see a 30-year police psychologist, and it's kind of funny because their office was really close to the police department. So I would literally park 5 blocks away, and I would walk to the place. And if I saw anybody I knew, a patrol car, anything, I'd just stop, hang out wherever I was. Wait, I didn't want to see anybody even see me going
there.
That's how bad that
was.
But I was grateful I had the anonymous visits. And so we did that. We did talk therapy. They wanted to give me drugs. I refused. I just didn't feel that that was going to be beneficial. It might have been, but I just was really resistant to that. And at the end of 6 sessions, my 30-year psychologist says, listen, in the 30 years I've been practicing, I've never seen a more severe case of PTSD. We've made little to no progress. And what I want to do is have you try a new radical therapy that only 6 people in the country are practicing. It's brand new. But I think it's worth it. However, because you've used your 6 visits, I now have to let your department know.
Oh, wow.
And we have to have permission for you to go to this advanced therapy. At that point, I really knew that it was like, okay, in my agency at that time, if you outed yourself in this way, your career was essentially over.
Sure.
You'd keep your job, but special assignments, new stuff, promotion, not going to happen.
Right.
So I was facing a literal suicide, because that's where I was, or a career suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a family, 2 young daughters, and frankly, it was a fairly easy choice at that point. I wanted to live and I wanted to thrive again.
Yeah.
So I went and got a radical new therapy, which is now mainstream, and it's EMDR.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing I want people to know about that that surprised me. I went there for that event. However, as we worked on that event, multiple things came out that I had forgotten about.
Right.
Supposedly. They were just repressed and buried deep.
Yep.
And this,
layers.
Whoa, there's another one. Whoa, there's another one. What the hell? And it was so disorienting to have them just emerge like that. But I only saw this man. His name was Dr. Andrew Leeds. He's still in practice, and
Wonderful.
He's a leading guy in EMDR. When I was done, I only had, I think, 4 or 5 sessions, and I was free.
Wow.
Free. I remember walking
amazing.
Out of the last session going, I feel amazing. And the beauty was I could still recall every detail of those events, but without the charge. I was free literally of them.
Yeah.
Of the baggage of it, you know, and wow, what a miracle.
But the energetic connection to them was no longer there.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that what that did for me is Dr. Leeds opened up a door to alternative healing modalities. Because at that time, this was so out there.
Sure.
So radically departed from traditional psychotherapy that people were like, yeah, that's probably just a bunch of crap.
Right.
But I'm like, wait a minute. That was the best thing I've ever been through. There's got to be more here. And so I just, I just kicked open the door and was like, okay, what else is there? I was like a kid in a candy store.
And now here you are.
And here I am.
Which is so remarkable because now Roger, remember, 20-year veteran of the police force in California, and now you yourself are?
I'm a sound healer.
A sound healer. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. So I've had a...
Sound?
Yeah, I know.
Healing?
Right.
What?
And I've had such a remarkable journey to that point. You know, I started studying with monks and mm-hmm. meditating with monks. I worked with doctors. I worked with psychologists. I got all kinds of training in biofeedback and stress management. I just kept exploring and kept exploring. I came across a Native American who's a fifth generation Apache shaman, and he loved me. He was in Vietnam, so he was a Vietnam veteran.
Okay.
And he loved the warrior aspect, and he personally trained me for 8 years. So I just kept getting deeper and deeper into it.
Yeah.
But I became really interested in frequency, vibrations, mm-hmm. sound, harmonic resonance, and our bodies are vibrating.
Yes.
Right? So it made sense to me that if we're vibrating in a harmonic resonance, like a monk meditating, that's the beautiful balanced place.
Right.
If we're in a disharmonic resonance, we're managing our stress with alcohol, drugs, extra sex, whatever it might be, right? Because we don't have a way of balancing. Mm-hmm. So we're only making the nervous system more and more dysfunctional, which was what I was doing with thrill-seeking and high-risk behaviors.
Sure. So looking to the outside to create the balance rather than the balance that's already available on the inside.
Yes, and destroying myself in the process, frying my adrenal glands.
Doing a great job.
Yeah. I was excelling.
Roger, the place that you're at now is something that is really so far removed from where you were, right? And even with your own experiences, like with the monks and... I know that you studied martial arts, for instance, and all of that, each one a stepping stone, obviously, that brought you to where, but you said sound healing. And I'm certain that there are some maybe in our audience that have never heard of sound healing. So before we go any further, can you just give us a description of like, what do you mean by sound healing?
For sure.
Are we healing our ears so we can hear better?
Well, certainly part of it. Yeah. So we're all vibration.
Okay.
And we are either vibrating in harmony or out of harmony. And when we're out of harmony, a lot of dysfunctional things are happening. When we're in harmony, we're in love, joy, happiness. Mm-hmm. Out of harmony, fear, anger, depression. So I started to look at the idea of, okay, if sound has vibration and the body has vibration, can sound create healing in the body? And I started to explore that. And we've actually been using sound and harmonic resonance for thousands upon thousands of years. When we see it in ancient cultures, it came through chanting, for example. Mm-hmm. Or instruments like a didgeridoo in Australia, right? Or a singing bowl from India that are actually tuned to certain frequencies.
Right.
Well, it turns out that these balance the energy centers in the body and calm the central nervous system. So I started to really study that. Like, what is that and how does it work? And what I came across was something remarkable. Back in the 1600s, the Gregorian monks were known for their chanting during Mass. And a couple of things would happen to people who experienced this. They would have either a divine communion, might be described as ecstatic bliss, where they just went into bliss consciousness, just from listening to sound, or they would experience a healing within their body, spontaneous healing, that things would just resolve like that. And this was well documented. So I started looking at the solfeggio frequencies, is what they were singing in these very special sounds, especially on the vowels. And so when we look at that, something very interesting happens. So there's a study of sound called cymatics. And an example of cymatics would be, let's say you have a metal plate,
mm-hmm.
and you sprinkle sand or salt on that plate, and then that's sitting on top of a speaker, or you've got a speaker wired to it. So now the vibration of the speaker transfers to the metal plate, the sand vibrates.
I think I've seen that on YouTube.
Yeah, you can see some great videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, that each of the sounds, there's six major sounds in the solfeggio scale, each one vibrates into a different sacred geometrical pattern.
Wow.
Which is stunning. I mean, and you can't argue this. Like, you can see
this
it in real time.
This is the kind of stuff that just blows you away.
Right.
Yeah.
And these patterns, we see them throughout the ages in hieroglyphics and on walls. And, I mean, paintings, all these kinds of things. So sacred geometry and sound have been connected forever. So these specific things line up with our energy centers, which is really an interesting thing.
Sure is.
So I decided to blend a little bit of the ancient technology with modern technology. And I found a company in Germany that has specially calibrated tuning forks. And those tuning forks are set to the solfeggio scale. And there's two kinds of forks. We have tonality forks,
okay,
where you hear them. And an interesting thing happens with those. So if I take one tuning fork and put it here, and a different fork and put it here, your brain is hearing two different frequencies. But it doesn't know how to deal with that. So it creates one frequency inside the brain.
Wow.
And it splits the difference in hertz. So you now have a certain hertz frequency that you can dial in.
Not that it hurts.
Not that it hurts. And so the beauty of this is it balances the left and right hemispheres of the brain, brings those into synchronicity.
Mm.
Then I have weighted tuning forks, which have no sound, but they vibrate that frequency. And I will use that like an acupuncturist would use a needle to broadcast the vibration into an area and break up congestion in there. So that's how those work together.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so to give you an example of how powerful this is, I had a client of mine, he's given me permission to use his name, but we'll leave it off for now. He is an amazing guy, and he's a police officer and had a very traumatic experience where his partner died in his arms after being shot.
Oh, God.
Okay, so in law enforcement, that's about the worst case scenario one could paint, is your brother dying in your arms. If I were to describe him physically, when he got on my table, it's sort of like a piece of wood. Absolutely rigid, like the body is just so held with
the word that just came to my mind was petrified.
Petrified, beautiful, perfect, because that's it, petrified.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, we got a little unwinding to do here. So I started working, doing my thing, and at one point I saw his entire being just go,
oh, wow.
And he instantly shifted. And I knew he was now not in the physical body, but in his energetic body. He literally let go. And I just kept working that energetic body, kept clearing out the interference patterns, clearing out the congestion. By the time we were done, he sat up and he goes, I don't know where I went.
Wow.
And I said,
so he had an out-of-body experience.
He did. And that was the first time in 30 years he had felt relaxed.
Can you imagine what that was like for him?
I cannot.
I mean, I could almost break down in tears actually thinking about that.
Life-altering moment.
Whoa.
And I said, this signature that you now have, you can remember this.
Yes.
And anytime you feel yourself getting hijacked by life events, memories, dreams, you can just simply feel the resonance I just put in your body.
A new baseline.
The beauty, because yes, he has a baseline. He can now, on his own, call in at any time he wants, and that's what he's doing today.
Wow.
So
amazing.
PTSD is like every light in your house and every plug has something in it. There's no more room for anything. That's why the littlest things can become befuddling. There was a great scene in a movie called The Hurt Locker where the soldier who's come back on leave, he's with his baby. He's never seen his baby, so he's got a one-year-old child that he's never seen. He's now suddenly a dad.
Yeah.
2 days before, he's in Fallujah disarming bombs, you know, and he's now back home. And his wife says, hey, you know, get out of the house for a little while because he's kind of nutting up. Go shopping. Pick some cereal up. And he's standing there in the cereal aisle, which, as you know, stretches the entire length of the store.
The entire length of the aisle.
And he's looking at it and he's like, ah, shit. Or just grabs a couple of boxes and throws them in there. He can't even handle the decision to pick up some cereal. It's so overwhelming. That's PTSD. And what I do with sound therapy is I unplug some of the circuits.
Wow.
I turn off some of the lights so that that isn't an overwhelming experience. There's room to let the day-to-day things come in.
And I imagine the thought of that is probably scary for people initially, right? Like, who will I be? if I let any of this down?
Yeah,
how
are.
Will I survive? How will I be in the world? So how do you get past that fear?
Yeah.
For them to be able to just trust you.
Yes.
To take them into a safe place.
100%. So that's my genius.
Mm.
And the reason I say it that way is that I'm really blessed in that I've walked the warrior's path.
Yeah.
I have lived it. And I myself have had to extricate myself out of the PTSD symptomologies
mm-hmm.
and into an empowered life. They look at me and they go, I feel safe with you because you understand me. I hear all the time when they're in front of a PhD who's got a suit and tie on,
yeah.
they're like, that dude doesn't know a damn thing about what I've been through. And they're right.
Yeah.
He doesn't. He's intellectually got it,
mm-hmm.
but he's never had to live it in his tissue. I've been there, and so just by alone, I have their trust.
Yeah.
Because they know that I'm going to keep them safe.
So right away, you're able to dissolve that first layer, the anxiety, the 100%. Stress, the crippling fear.
Yeah, crippling.
Right. Crippling.
Crippling.
Fear that has brought them to you, right?
Yes.
To get the healing that they need rather than the Band-Aid on the symptom.
Which gives me such a degree of gratitude for everything that I've been through.
Oh, yeah.
Because the journey, you know, I wouldn't wish it on anyone per se, but it would have never awoken this modality of healing that I've developed. And I believe that this is one of many now that are coming to light. And what I love about that is people can explore now. They can play now. They can take responsibility to seek something that resonates with them.
Yeah.
It might not be sound. It might be cranial sacral.
Sure.
It might be Reiki. It might be a shaman praying
sure.
over you. Who cares?
Doesn't matter.
Seek it, find it, and take a step.
I think it also has added a whole other layer of hope.
Yes.
Because what I have found myself is that so often working with people that have tried everything in the more conventional sector,
yeah.
that are hopeless.
Yes.
Nothing works.
Yes.
And it's because so often it's a symptom that's being treated, and the healing is not that it's intentionally withheld, but it's intentionally withheld merely by the processing that is missing its mark.
It is. It's there's a line right out of Apocalypse Now. It's a Band-Aid on a machine gun.
Yeah.
And we can kind of manage it. But, you know, I have quite a few of my friends who are on psychiatric medication for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And their life is a dysfunctional hell.
Right.
Just the slightest bit of edge has been taken off. So it's kind of okay and manageable.
Mm-hmm.
And what they don't realize is that there is broader ways to seek actual healing.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of them have given up. A lot of them have given up.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them.
I
understand this place.
Well, there's also a whole, you know, psychology when you recognize that the functionality of your life is dependent on a medication,
yeah.
on something outside of you. When in truth, there's so much empowerment that happens when we have the proper tools, when we have the actual experiences like people get on your table,
yeah.
right? Where they feel this new connect and recognize that I actually have memory of this.
And so much of the struggles we have an emotional connection,
sure.
always present. It just depends on the degree.
Sure.
I had a lady who was on my table, and not a police officer, just a civilian who's going through life,
mm-hmm.
and had severe hearing loss.
Yeah.
So we were working on, I pick up on things, like I just kind of sense the area, and it was right in this throat area, right?
So you're an intuitive healer, aside from
I would say that's true.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So I felt this constriction around here. And in this area, of course, this is about speaking and honoring our truth.
Mm.
And the other side of that coin is also being heard.
Right.
Right. Because we can speak our truth, but
yeah.
it may not be received. So I cleared this out. And it's very interesting when I use the tuning fork, its pitch will change when there's a problem.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So once I get a clean tone, then I know we've worked that out, put it back in the body to move through, right? She calls me the next day and leaves a voicemail message, said, we need to talk immediately. And I'm like,
okay,
something must have happened during the healing.
Yeah.
Maybe not good. You know, let's just see what's up. She goes, well, I got to work and all my coworkers were talking so loud. And then my phone was ringing. It was ringing so loud. And she said, I have spontaneously recovered my hearing. I'm like, what?
Wow.
Like, I did not, you know.
Not necessarily your intention.
It really wasn't. I was just removing congestion
here,
right? Well, she had a spontaneous recovery of hearing loss for 20 years where the doctors had told her, there's nothing we can do for you except a radical surgery that might leave you deaf permanently.
Oh, my God.
I was blown away as she was, you know, of course, because that's just a pretty shocking result. But this really goes to demonstrate how the emotional congestion can either make a problem worse or can even be the direct cause of that problem.
Sure.
So this is the beauty of alternative therapies. They
right.
offer you hope that we can move beyond just managing something.
Right. And how wonderful that as more and more is coming to light and being widely accepted by the entire population of the globe, really, we're just seeing that, you know, these alternative therapies, so many of them, by the way, have their roots in ancient healing.
Yeah.
But coming and partnering with conventional, more traditional medicine and how powerful it is when we're collaborative and we can work together and recognize that rather than being intimidated by each other, that we have something that can complement what you're doing, what I'm doing, and together we create this offering that is so whole and complete. And
I just think it's beautiful.
It is.
I love it. I love the awakening that's happening.
Yeah.
And more people are moving away from allopathic medicine into what's considered alternative therapies. And I don't want to ever put down, you know, the Western model.
No, each has its place.
You bet. I mean, if I get in a car wreck and my body's all broken, oh my God, are we amazing at putting it back together?
Line them up for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But when you reach a point where you're only able to manage something,
mm-hmm.
I think that's really a good time to begin this exploration because we have other ways.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My God.
I know that there are many people out here watching this and listening to this interview that would love to know how to contact you.
Absolutely. The easiest way is to connect with me via email and or on Facebook. So the email address is transformwithroger, and Roger has a D in it, R-O-D-G-E-R, @gmail.com. Or you can find me on Facebook, and Facebook is just my name, Roger Ruge. Ruge is spelled R-U-G-E. I'm the only one, so you'll be able to find me.
Fantastic. Really, thank you again. And thanks for everything that you are doing to bring this new awareness forward. Every little bit of information that we share brings us all to a higher level. And, of course, creates a life that we're meant to live. And we deserve to live.
Oh, deserve to live is right.
Right.
I love that word. And thank you so much for being the bright light that you are and allowing me to present this to your beautiful community. I'm joyful to share it.
Oh, thank you. And thank you to each and every one of you for joining us here today. This has been my honor and, of course, my greatest joy to be here and to share this information with you. And I'm confident that you'll leave this interview and be different, be able to look at things differently and ask different questions. And that's really the key. Just ask different questions. So many blessings to you. And thank you again from the bottom of my heart. I'm Marcy Newman, your Heart Shift Coach.